everybody. This is Chris.
And Kathy.
We wanted to take a minute to thank you all for tuning in. We appreciate every listener and are grateful for this platform.
Please help us share our vision by subscribing to our show through your favorite streaming app. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at Petability Podcast.
Check out our ever-growing list of affiliates and sponsors. Simply go to the show notes for information and links.
And be sure to use our promo code PETPOD22, that's PETPOD22, on checkout to receive your discount from our affiliates. And now here's a word from our sponsor.
Hi, I'm Alon Landa, CEO of MedcoVet, and I'm a proud sponsor of Petability. We decided to partner with Chris and Kathy because, like them, we want to empower all pet owners who are trying to do the most for their pets. At MedcoVet, we specialize in advanced home laser therapy for pets. Laser therapy is a safe and effective treatment for common conditions like arthritis and wounds, and it relieves pain for most conditions caused by inflammation. With MedcoVet, pet owners can perform this treatment at home while receiving support from experienced clinicians. If you think your pet would benefit from healing at home, visit MedcoVet.com, and one of our clinical experts will work with you to determine if home laser therapy is the right fit for you and your pet. Tell them Petability sent you.
Welcome to Petability. I'm your host, Kathy Simons.
And I'm your host, Chris Cranston. Our podcast provides interviews and information to help your pets live their best lives.
Good morning, Kathy. What's new?
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
I'm well.
I do have something new to share with you today. I started taking the certified fear-free classes for veterinary professionals, but it's open to a lot of people. It's open to not just veterinarians and veterinary technicians, but all animal professionals, groomers and trainers. And so far, it's been fantastic. It's just, I don't know. It just makes me think, okay, we're doing it right. We're doing it right. So I highly recommend it. Yeah, I highly recommend it.
Is this online or in person?
Online? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was a fee for it. It was totally reasonable fee. There is, for those of us who are veterinary technicians or veterinarians, there are race approved CEUs for that. So if you're looking for something really good, really interesting, and something that falls in line with what you believe in, then those certified fear-free classes are good. I'm really enjoying them.
So my main question to you is, why am I just learning about this now?
I don't know. I don't know. I didn't realize there were.
You held out on me.
I held out. I just wanted to be cool and be like, I'm certified fear-free. No, I found out from my, remember we did an interview with our friend Megan Terwilliger, the groomer, when we talked yes. about mobility and grooming. If you haven't listened to that, you should go back and listen to that one. She's certified fear-free. And so she turned me on to it. So I started taking the classes yesterday. So they're good. Awesome. I think you should try it. Yeah, I think you should give it a try.
And ironically, I was just talking about this whole movement in veterinary medicine with a client yesterday. They had gotten a new puppy and the owner was saying how she thinks with this puppy, she can managed to do a lot of the grooming and his yeah. meet his care needs herself, where she missed that boat with the older dog that I'm treating, Teddy.
Yeah.
And I said, oh my gosh, you know, there's tons of stuff out there. And, you know, we talked about, you know, how to make it happen and how to it to be positive and to get the pets buy-in and so yeah. forth.
Good information. It's good information.
Absolutely. So here we are with another fabulous guest, but I must say that this is the first guest that we're speaking to that is actually in Europe. That's kind of exciting.
I know, right?
Yes. Yes. So we're going to be talking today about, it's a big long word, so don't get turned off, people, neuroplasticity. But how I kind of took it, and we'll leave it up to our esteemed guest to define it and break it down, but kind of how the nervous system adapts, you know, to injury, trauma, disease processes, and so forth. And not only is this relevant for neurological injuries and such, but also orthopedic issues. Right. So I'm very excited to learn from Amy Lemereau Hesbach. So Amy and I go way back. I think that we were all kind of part of the first wave when it comes to being certified in small animal rehabilitation. And Amy's background is that she is a doctor of physical therapy and both certified as a therapist and practitioner, which there are two certification programs in the United States. And she is certified in both of them and has lectured extensively for both programs and so forth. She is the owner of Empower Physio, and she provides comprehensive, forward-thinking, focused, and personalized solutions to mobility challenges for people, pets, pet parents, and animal physical therapy and rehabilitation professionals worldwide.
Really worldwide.
So she was previously practicing here in the Boston area and has since moved to The Hague in the Netherlands. And she is certainly a mentor of mine, an esteemed colleague, and she provides remote coaching now through, I think it's an online platform called Teachable. Amy can correct me if I'm wrong there. But one other tidbit of information talking about her impact on people is not only is she a friend and colleague, but she is my former Pilates instructor.
Ooh,
so, yeah,
wow.
So I can speak from personal experience how her knowledge, both educationally, hands-on, and using various tools has impacted me in a positive way.
Yeah.
So without further ado, I'm going to welcome Amy Hesbach.
Welcome, Amy.
Hi. Hi, Chris. Hi, Kathy.
Hey.
Great to chat with you guys again. And boy, Chris, I don't know if I sound good or bad based on your introduction, the Pilates part especially. but yeah, I'm glad to join you guys and talk to you a little bit about neuroplasticity. And it sounds like such a big word and it sounds so kind of scary, but it's a really interesting process, I think. You know, like you said, it's really the method by which the nervous system responds to injury. And what fascinates me about neuroplasticity is that it has that applicability to all injury, not just neuro injury, but orthopedic, anything else, stub your toe, you know, we start that neuroplastic process. So, you know, during the whole COVID times, you know, between board games and puzzles and reading books, I was, you know, catching up on some reading and learning more about this concept and how it applies in rehabilitation, just finding it super fascinating. So,
right. And obviously I want you to delve into, you know, neuroplasticity and, you know, explain it to our audience, but you know, why did you gain interest in this particular topic? And you frankly approached us because you wanted to, you know, I think present this to a wider audience because you feel that it's so important.
Yeah, you know, it is important. And you know, back in the day when I first started working with animals, you know, at being a physical therapist trained on human patients and starting to work in the veterinary field, I found that one of the things that I would say almost universally with pet owners, pet parents of pets who've had an injury or had surgery, they were always so tentative and sometimes afraid to touch their pet after injury or after surgery, you know, afraid that they were going to do harm. And, and I really, really always emphasize to them, put your hands on your pet, you know, make that connection mentally with them. But as I was reading and as I was learning more, I realized that it's a physical connection too, and that physical connection can influence their recovery. It was so, so fascinating to me. You know, it actually goes way back to when I did a residency after physical therapy school. I went to California, and here's another big word for you. Proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation. So I did a residency in this, I guess, treatment philosophy, and learning more about the proprioceptive system, about the sensory system, and how that facilitates recovery and function and all of that in people who are recovering from injury, and then being able to apply a lot of these concepts to animals too. So it's, you know, it's fascinating to me how we've taken something that is a bit maybe archaic and old with regards to concepts of rehabilitation and able to apply it even now in modern times and with incredible efficacy and efficiency and to aid and assist us in helping our patients and our pets to recover from injury. So neuroplasticity is really the way by which the nervous system recovers from injury. And, you know, previously we thought as therapists, we had to really just teach the patient how to compensate, how to substitute, how to get by with what they had left. And many times we were just waiting for recovery, just waiting for the healing process to happen. But now we're learning that those interventions that we apply, just putting our hands on and other activities we might do in rehabilitation, they actually do influence the brain and they influence the outcome, the function of the patient. So it's really incredible. And it's just lent a lot of legitimacy, I think, to what we know in rehabilitation and physical therapy.
Amy, are you saying that there's sort of an emotional component to the recovery and neuroplasticity?
So thinking emotional, but also sensory. So it's about the experience. A lot of this ties into motor learning and motor control. And we know now that when we learn a new skill, and it's funny because we're spelling this out in the research, but I think in the back of our minds, we understand this, but if there's motivation, if we have an effect on our environment, if, you know, we're enjoying ourselves, if we're not fearful or stressed, if we're comfortable and not painful, then we learn faster, we learn better, mm-hmm. And we recover faster and better. And so it all does tie in. And you know, you were talking about your fear-free certification. And I'm like, okay, let me jot that down. It's something I need to do because it sounds right up my alley, right? It sounds like it ties into everything that we want to provide for our pets when they're recovering, you know, with rehabilitation. So, so a lot of what we teach, you know, in teaching neuroplasticity, you know, techniques and teaching pet parents is, you know, put their hands on, find a comfortable place for the pet when they're recovering. So rather than restricting them 100% to a crate in the corner in a dark closet, wherever that might be, you know, allow them to interact with their environment, socially interact with the family, see the squirrels outside and the birds and the trees and all these things, and give them some positive feedback and a positive sensory experience so that that can enhance their recovery. It is pretty fascinating when you think about the sensory experience and how that changes things. You know, it really changes our perspective, I think, too.
Wow. Amy, can we maybe for the audience could you do a little brief maybe review of basic anatomy and how it pertains to the subject? So what is the nervous system and what is its role in our function or in their function?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It makes a lot of sense, actually. It really does tie in. And, you know, and it's funny when I'm teaching this, we really do go back to the basics of neuroanatomy and trying to understand the nervous system. So the nervous system, you have the central and the peripheral nervous system. The central is the brain and the spinal cord. The peripheral are all those nerves that, you know, connect to our muscles, connect to our organs, connect to our skin, you know, all the way down to the tips of our toes and our fingertips. And, you know, the key component of neuroplasticity and kind of the building block of the nervous system is this cause and effect. So you apply a stimulus, some sensory input. So just touching your pet, that's going to activate receptors in the skin. And as the fur coat attaches to the skin, it's going to activate these receptors. They're going to send signals through the peripheral nerves, through the spinal cord to the brain, and they're going to be perceived by the brain. So they're going to create that experience and what we would call a map. The brain. So I don't know if any of you are familiar with what we call a homunculus. So it's like a picture of a body on the brain. And, you know, there are different parts of the brain that are associated with different areas of the body and the sensations that we feel. So with people, you know, our sense of taste, our sense of smell, and our sense of touch are really very sensitive. And so those senses take up a lot of, you know, a lot of area, a lot of space on the brain or on the sensory cortex. And that space and that perception influences the outcome or the output from the brain. So the connection of the brain to the spinal cord, to the nerves, to the muscles. So this is called a reflex arc. And if you think about touching a hot stove or, you know, God forbid, stubbing your toe, you know, you feel that pain sensation, which is actually a perception of pain, but that sense goes to the brain and then in effect goes to those muscles. But in actuality, we have this really quick reflex that doesn't even have to be acknowledged by the brain. So you pull your hand away from the hot stove, you hop on one foot when you've stubbed your toe, you know, those are reflexes. And those are things that happen without even control of the brain or control of the central nervous system. So when we've had an injury, like we've had surgery or God forbid, you know, a disc herniation or something of the sort where we're, you know, having some pressure on a nerve, that homunculus, that map of the brain is rewritten. And so there may not be appropriate input to the brain, appropriate sensation, you know, appropriate, you know, reception from the body. So the brain doesn't really know what to do with that space. So it allows kind of other areas that have normal sensation to kind of take over that real estate in the brain. And then in effect, because we have abnormal input, we get abnormal or absent output. So we get, you know, paralysis. We have, you know, dysfunction in contracting muscles and moving our body because of those abnormalities and sensation. And then it just continues to go in this loop because then our feedback into the brain is altered as well. So, you know, for us as therapists to really intervene and make changes in that loop and to provide appropriate input and to reteach kind of that map for the patient, that's part of that experience and really part of rehab and recovery and ways that we can teach the nervous system to recover. In fact, we can help the rest of the system recover as well functionally. You know, we learn a lot about this plasticity and how it's really heightened that ability to like change and modify the brain and that experience. It's really, you know, willing to be modified when we're growing up, like when we're little, right? And we're learning new things and new skills. But then it's also, we also have that opportunity to learn when we've had an injury too. And then throughout life, you know, I talk about teaching old dogs new tricks and yep. We never really stop learning. We never really stop, you know, remolding and rewriting this sensory input. And I think what's so cool and amazing about this is that we have this technology now where we can see the parts of the brain that light up when we are exposed to a different, you know, sensation or a memory or music. And we can see these connections scientifically. And, you know, and so it's really giving us a lot of ammunition and a lot of evidence for what we're doing in rehabilitation, the experience that we're providing our patients.
Yeah. And when you say light up, that's like in a CT scan or MRI or something like that.
Yeah. Where... Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly.
So let's talk then a little bit more about the nuts and bolts. I mean, you alluded to it. There's kind of, I think, three, you know, methodologies by which the nervous system recovers from injury or trauma. And the first is regeneration. And that's very slow in my, is my impression. And then, like you said, this compensation and substitution, and maybe we can give an example of that. And then let's get into some examples of neuroplasticity. So those are the kind of the three ways, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So regeneration is really just the general healing of the nervous system. And there are parts of the nervous system that certainly have a hard time healing without some kind of intervention. And what we're learning in the research too is that it's not just the cells and the neurons, the building blocks of the nervous system that have to regenerate, but also there has to be a good environment for regeneration. So all the cells that, you know, break it down and build it up, you know, it has to be healthy. They've talked about the toxic environment, cellular environment for people who have like dementia or Alzheimer's, and that, you know, they have a really hard time recovering or maybe don't recover because that environment is really toxic. So, you know, so all the right pieces have to be in place for regeneration to happen, for recovery to happen, and that healing to happen. And then with compensation and substitution, you know, this is just kind of a natural way. And especially with animals, they don't, especially dogs, they don't want to be left behind. They don't want to be the trailing member of the pack. So they have a need to keep up. So if, you know, one leg isn't working right, then they learn how to get around on three legs. You know, it's amazing to see how well they substitute and how well they compensate. And so it's, you know, it's kind of part of rehabilitation and part of recovery, but at the same time, can it get in the way of healing? You know, when they are so insistent upon using those three strong legs that to reteach that fourth leg how to work and how to move correctly is a bit of a challenge in rehabilitation. So with neuroplasticity, we're really trying to promote use of the whole body, you know, and utilization of all of those pieces.
So I'm going to go back a little bit. You know, when you're talking about like the three-legged dog, you know, I think this has happened to all of us where, you know, maybe there's an orthopedic injury such as a tear of a ligament in the knee, you know, the cranial cruciate ligament, so common. They have surgery. There is no apparent physical reason by which that dog should not be utilizing that limb. But yet it persists in holding it up because they can move faster on three legs than slowing down to use that fourth one. And I have had so many owners just intuitively say, well, why don't we just tie up the other leg? You know, and kind of force that usage. Yeah. Now, I think as rehabilitationists, that's a little extreme. We wouldn't do that, but there are methods. And I think this speaks to the neuroplasticity, right, Amy, where we can enhance the use of that fourth leg by maybe putting a counter irritant on the other leg or something as simple as a bootie. You know, I put a boot on the quote good leg, the opposite leg, and it feels weird. So back to your sensory,
it feels weird. Absolutely neuroplasticity.
And then they'll be more likely to use the leg that they've been holding up.
Exactly. So, you know, there are a lot of different methods that we utilize in rehabilitation that fall under that umbrella of neuroplasticity. And that's one of them. So the dog has torn a ligament in the knee and had instability, but through surgery and through rehabilitation, you know, mechanically, the knee should be able to tolerate, the limb should be able to tolerate weight bearing and return to normal activity again. And, you know, so there are techniques, you know, we would call it constraint-induced movement therapy or forced use in rehabilitation. And now you've got to have, you know, kind of some of the basics in place already. You're not going to force, you know, weight bearing on a limb that isn't ready for it. But, you know, these are the ways that we influence the brain and influence the nervous system. So we have to reteach use. We have to reteach sensation because the sensation is altered on that limb. You know, we have to reteach so many different things, the muscles contracting with the right timing and coordination, you know, all of these things. It's interesting in the research, and a lot of it is on, you know, rats and cats and things, but also on human subjects who were like athletes, for instance. So they've done studies of, you know, maybe CT or functional MRI of the brain in athletes that have had an ACL tear and how they recover. And they find that that homunculus, that cortical map has been altered because of the injury, you know, even after surgery of the knee, even though all the pieces are there and it should function normally, there's still a change in that sensory map. And so as therapists, you know, we really, we get in there and we try to enhance the sensation and give more feedback to the patient. So we might use, you know, manual therapies, hands-on therapies. We might use different exercises and techniques to improve awareness of that leg or of that knee and improve better control of the leg too. So it is so interesting and so fascinating, actually, you know, what we do as therapists and now understanding a little bit as to why or how it can be successful or how we can be more successful in rehabilitation. Yeah, it's a lot of it. It's about that sensory experience, about the environment and, you know, and giving feedback. I think, you know, a lot of the interventions that we provide, you know, it might be electrical stimulation or we might be using like a massage therapy tool or something like that or a vibration plate. And it's not so much even kinesiology tape. It's not so much about the mechanical activity. I mean, sure, that's part of it, but a lot of it is about the sensory change, you know, the environment and making it real and functional for the patient.
So I was doing a little bit of research in preparation for this podcast and, you know, going back to the regeneration, you know, I often tell my pet parents that, you know, the nervous system is slow to regenerate from a physical point of view, but it's also very resilient. And that's, you know, kind of what we're talking about and how can we facilitate that, speed up the recovery, the function, because that's ultimately what's so important. You know, it doesn't matter so much maybe what's happening, you know, and what we can't see and so forth, but what is the function of that individual in their daily life? That's what we're all trying to maximize. And regeneration depends on, you know, a number of factors. You know, you're talking about the environment that the nerve cells may be in and so forth. But, you know, how serious was that injury, the type of injury that was sustained to the nervous system? And, you know, if the nerve is bruised or traumatized but not cut, it should, if everything's going well, regenerate in about 6 to 12 weeks. Is that accurate, Amy?
Yeah, probably so. You know, you have to have all the pieces together and yeah, like you said, the right environment. And yeah.
And then if it is cut, a nerve regenerates at a growth rate of 1 millimeter per day after about a 4-week initial rest period following that injury is what I'd read. So again, very slow, very minuscule, but it's there and it has that capability. So anyway, just getting people to kind of understand why maybe some things are not happening as quickly as they would like, but that's where we come in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think too, it is hard to visualize when you talk about neurologic injury. It's hard to visualize what is going on. It's at a cellular level, you know, it's at that microcellular level. You know, we're talking about proteins and cytokines and all these crazy little, you know, little pieces and cells in the environment that really influence recovery and influence regeneration. It's not like we can just take an x-ray and we can see, okay, yeah, the bone is healing. You know, there are more cells here. There's more bony material here. You know, it's really, we're not even able to see this stuff on an MRI, on a normal MRI as to what is happening with regards to recovery and regeneration. And so we don't always know how much trauma the nervous system has been through through and how much damage is there, much less the secondary effects, you know. So the pet that maybe has had a disc injury and had surgery because of a disc injury, there's probably been pressure, bruising, compression, inflammation around that nerve for a long time before we even detected the injury. And so we have to deal with not just the recovery of the surgical site, but also the recovery from the damage that was done before. You know, and if we're not getting normal input from the sensory system, you know, and not that the receptors are the problem, but the tracks or the pathways through the nervous system are blocked in some way. And, you know, the animal, the person needs to learn how to use other pathways, you know, and to get those senses to the nervous system so that we can get a better response and a more normal response. So it's a lot of, you know, retraining and things that, you know, we don't always know. We don't always have that predictability in recovery, unfortunately. Right. But that is, it is super amazing and magical when you do see that recovery and when you see these glimmers of, you know, feeling and movement and all these things that do start to happen. So with neuroplasticity, we have, you know, you have all these pathways that are normally utilized, but then you have others that may be a little silent. And so when there's been an injury, those silent pathways could be woken up a bit and could be utilized by the nervous system and by the body. You know, so it's teaching an old dog new tricks, you know, using these new pathways, but using pathways that have been there all along, but they just haven't been used before. So they talk about neuroplasticity and how a novel or a new stimulus, something new, a new experience is actually more beneficial than just the same old thing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so new, like the new snow, or, you know, new, like a new environment. You know, many years ago, I worked with a patient after back surgery, and she was having a really hard time recovering and learning how to walk again. And at that time, we looked at the dog wheelchairs and carts. And we said, you know, that's the last resort. We don't want to go there. You know, we don't want to give up. But, you know, I think a light bulb went off in my head. And I said, you know, why can't we use it for a little bit of our session? You know, not have it be the end result, but, you know, let's use it as a tool in rehabilitation. Yeah. And so we had an old cart sitting around the office, and we put her in it, and I got a tennis ball, and I will tell you, this dog ran and ran and ran, and we played ball, and it was just this light bulb going off in her brain and her nervous system, you know, of remembering what it's like to run and to move and to be free and to have that positive experience again of playing ball. You know, it was so amazing. And then we get her out of the cart, and it's, you know, everything's pumped up and excited and, you know, and ready to learn and ready to, you know, to try new things. But it's, you know, it's changing that experience and, you know, providing that motivation too.
And imagine how great the dog must feel too, when they have that independence and chasing the ball. Exciting. But this brings us to like another topic, Amy. Can we discuss a little bit about some of the tools that we use as rehabbers, and kind of explain how we use them from from a neuroplasticity viewpoint?
Sure. Yeah. So the cart is a great example. You know, the using a treadmill or using an underwater treadmill in the same way. You know, I feel like as rehabbers, we step back sometimes, we slow everything down. We want everything to look really good. We're very patient. And, you know, and we're helping these patients to step. So we've got a treadmill going, and they're on the treadmill. We've got some sling support maybe, and we're placing their legs, and we're going very deliberate and trying to reteach them how to step and how to move. And, you know, and this is, it's half of the puzzle, honestly. And in that, to really activate the nervous system and to cue into some of that reflexive movement and that natural movement of walking is to have the speed, you know, faster and the frequency of the steps faster and more normal. So, you know, so for this dog in the cart and running around and playing with a ball, the benefit was maybe not so much the running around and playing with the ball, though that was a great thing for motivation, but it was moving quickly and moving at a more natural pace. And so it resembled more the normal function, the normal mobility, and the normal activity for this pet. So all the research that is pointing in the direction of using what we would call gait training or locomotor training is actually suggesting that we need to do it fast. We need to do it high intensity. We need to do it at, you know, kind of normal walking or trotting paces. You know, we need to give support, but we also need to give feedback and feel those footfalls and feel the environment and how we change the environment. So that is certainly a huge part of rehabilitation. You know, exercises and activities that we do in rehab, you know, even using like a therapy ball or a physio ball or a peanut type of inflatable device, you know, they're great for providing maybe some, you know, varied input and, you know, and the patient has to balance better or use core muscles more, and it's a bit more challenging. But at the same time, there's that sensory input, that kind of vibration and that contact with the skin, with the fur coat, with those sensory receptors, and providing more of that sensory input while we're doing that functional activity. You know, the weight bearing activities, all these things, you know, I think more about the sensory component of the interventions that we do, the activities that we do in therapy, now than just the activity and what muscle is contracting mm-hmm. and, you know, where we need to build strength or balance, et cetera. You know, kinesiology taping is another tool in the toolbox that really relates quite a bit to neuroplasticity. And we use kinesiology tape with people. We would traditionally say that we use it to maybe, you know, help to relax a muscle or stretch it or give support to the body. And, you know, it's not so much a mechanical intervention as it is a sensory intervention. It's, you know, I look at that tape as a way to take my hands home or send my hands home with the patient to just remind them, yeah, this is the muscle that we want to be, you know, contracting. We want you to pay attention to this area of your body. And so I find that it's a great adjunct to the hands-on therapies that we do as well. So all of it, when we're talking about neuroplasticity, and again, it does bring us back to, these are the basics of what we do in rehabilitation. And this is the why we do what we do. It's about that sensory experience hand in hand with, you know, the physical therapy and the rehab techniques that we do.
I know sometimes my patients, or the clients, I should say, look at me. Well, they probably both do. Like, I have three heads, but and sometimes it's hard to articulate like why we're doing this. You know, some people get it and they're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And other people are like, really? You want me to do this?
Yeah. So if we think about the neuroanatomy and what happens, so, you know, you have all these different receptors. So you have receptors for vibration, you have receptors for temperature, you have receptors for light touch, for pain, et cetera. So in each of these receptors is connected to a different pathway, a track that goes up into the brain. And so if one of those tracks or one of those pathways is blocked, then we have to activate different receptors, heat and cold, you know, ice and changes in temperature, using pressure or light touch brushing, you know, mm-hmm. like those wire brushes versus a softer brush, you know, they're all providing different types of stimuli. They're activating different receptors, that's activating different pathways to the brain. And finally, you're feeling that sense, hopefully, within the central nervous system and getting a response, you know, and I think that's key, you know, going to, with these neurological patients, going to the tail, going to the toes, you know, the end of that nervous system, where we have all these, you know, cutaneous nerves that, and all these receptors and things. I find that could be a really strong component, you know, and a strong method by which we access the nervous system.
And I think it's good here to again remind the pet parents that, of course, safety is important, but our pets are not as fragile as they may think. And I always remind them that, you know, before this injury, think about when they were running around in the yard and wiping out and, you know, and so forth. Or even like we have little nubs on a lot of the tools that we use, and that's sensory feedback through their toes. And the owners will say, doesn't that hurt their feet? I'm like, oh my gosh, they're running around on gravel, rocks, lumps, clumps, you know, outside. No, this is not going to hurt their feet. This is good sensory through their feet to wake things up.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we've learned too, that if we activate the receptors on the opposite leg, we're actually activating some of those same areas of the brain too. So, you know, so if your pet is immediately after surgery, after injury, you know, and we're too tentative or too cautious to really put our hands on that fresh knee or that fresh incision, which we should certainly avoid, you know, in the case of infection and all these other things. But, you know, we can go elsewhere. We can treat the nervous system indirectly. We can, you know, massage the shoulders, and we can touch the head and the toes, and, you know, we can go to other areas of the body and have a similar benefit. It's that feedback and that awareness that we're developing. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's about that sensory input and how can we do that. Now, a word of caution too, it's, you know, sometimes too much is too much, right? You know, right. Sometimes we have to go a little slower and we don't want to overwhelm the system. And I find that animals are really easy to facilitate. They're really easy to stimulate. And so sometimes if I'm trying to do my rehab work, my sensory work, and I'm in a really busy environment and there's a lot going on, that's just way too much for the nervous system, way too much for any of us to manage or comprehend. So, you know, it's a continuum. You know, we start somewhere and then, you know, we gauge the response of the patient and the pet and, you know, really paying attention to, you know, how their eyes look, their ears look, their tail, you know, are they enjoying themselves? Is this relaxing to them or is it stressing them out? You know, and really looking to them for feedback as to how they feel mm-hmm. about their rehab experience.
We like to, Chris and I always like to talk about set the environment for this. You know, when I work at some other places, I make sure that, I'm at a place where it's quiet and there isn't any other dog running around and there's not a lot of barking and, you know, I got the treats and it, you know, I love to have all the great, you know, fancy equipment, the treadmills and the e-stim and the laser, but really getting this buy-in from the dog and me putting my hands on the dog and using some creative things like brushing, are really, beneficial to the patient, and just sort of, you know, getting the buy-in from the animal as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, it is, it's about the environment and that, you know, you mentioned treats and things like that. And, you know, think about the sense of smell. So right. In an animal, you know, the area of the brain that is responsive to the sense of smell is huge. Mm-hmm. And what we know too, even with the research on human patients and human subjects is that the areas that are most responsive to sensory input, it's smell and it's the area of the brain associated with memory. And so if you think about like the treatment environment, you know, what memory do they have? What do they associate with a certain toy or a certain place that they're in? You know, you think about even driving down the street and your dog knows exactly where you're going based on the turns that you're taking in the car, you know, and the smells. You know, I make so many friends at the dog park just because I have, you know, little bits and crumbs in my pocket that I can't even
carry bacon in your pocket, Amy.
But they know yeah. They're there, you know, and it's that memory and that sensory memory that they've created. But for us, I think as humans, as pet owners and parents and therapists, you know, for us to step back and try to perceive the world from their perspective, you know, and what is important to them and what is motivating to them and what is stressful and fearful to them as well, you know, not to anthropomorphize or give them human qualities, but to just experience it like they would, or look at it through their perspective.
And I work with a variety of animals other than dogs. I have a special interest in birds. And so I work with a lot of parrots and macaws and, you know, cockatiels and budgies. And that's a completely different language than your dogs and your cats. And setting the environment for them is so crucial, especially being the kind of, you know, prey animal like that. And so really an individual patient, each patient has their own needs and each patient has their own emotional needs. And then you have to, read that. You have to read the room, or read the patient, and set that tone, for them as well.
A lot of times after, a neurological impact, let's say a disc herniation, or even just after surgery and the effects of medications and things, there may be an issue with your dog going to the bathroom, right? Urinating on their own again, that sort of thing. And so, you know, talking about the environment, we often say, go to their normal place in the yard by that tree that they always lifted their leg. And that can be very, again, motivating to your point of seeing the world through their eyes. You know, maybe, you know, they're not going to go on a pee pad in the house. That's not normal for them. So, you know, make that effort to provide the, I was talking about stimulus cues, you know, their typical normal stimulus cues where they have those sights, sounds, but especially smells to do what they innately need to do to function.
Chris, I had a patient years ago who had needed a wheelchair for daily living. And the owners were sort of a little bit hesitant. And the first day we got that dog into the wheelchair, we walked him outside. He walked over. He's a big Great Dane. He walks over to the bushes, sniffs and pees on the bushes. And the owner and I are like, we were like, if I had a football, I would have spiked it. Cause we were just like, yes, this is exactly what we were waiting for. This dog was able to get up at his height, go and sniff the tree, go and sniff the bush, and then pee on it. And the look of satisfaction was like, and I was like, yes.
And he did it himself. You know, I think himself. That's the thing. It's like, it's the motivation and the independence and the, and making those decisions, right? It's those choices. That's just, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. Felt really good.
So if a pet parent asks, you know, so I'm getting my dog up, I'm using a sling or a harness, but you're putting them over a ball or a peanut. I don't get it. I don't understand. How is that different? They're standing, you know, both ways. Why are both important? How would you answer that, Amy?
Yeah, that's a really good point. A really good question. You know, I think it is, a lot of it is about the sensory experience. It's, you know, it's about, you know, kind of the weight bearing, the input through the paws, through the feet. And, but also, you know, when you're over the ball or on the physio roll, you know, that's a different sensory experience. You know, we're activating the vestibular system, the balance system, and even these different reactions that we have for what we would call equilibrium or balance or writing. So staying upright, you know, and giving them support. It's interesting, giving them support from below versus, you know, from above. Yep. It's, you know, it's a very different experience. I think too, when you're using the physio roll or physio ball, a lot of times we're supporting their trunk. And so, you know, if we can support their trunk completely, then maybe we'll get more feedback, more activity from the limbs. You know, maybe they can lift their head a little bit higher. Maybe they can, you know, just by taking some weight off, you know, maybe we can provide them enough support that they can be a little more independent about their mobility. But yeah, I think the variety of experiences too is very, very important. You know, the ball, those inflatables, those are completely novel things, you know, they're things that they're not experienced with. So, you know, again, that experience is going to activate different receptors and different pathways and, you know, and create different memories for them.
And I always ask my pet parents to imagine themselves as the dog. And, you know, I'm like, you know, hanging you know, by a sling, for example, you know, through your rear end, or, you know, being placed over a peanut, I think that's pretty easy for folks to imagine how that would feel different and, you know, why they both may be of value and use at different times. You know, the sling is obviously mobile, you know, so you can use it for taking them outside, and the, you know, the peanut roll can be more for a static exercise, but they're both equally valid and important for the sensory experience, as you say.
Yeah. And I think too, when we're using a sling or a harness or something to give them some support, there's a certain amount of what we would call like bracing and compensatory contractions and just stiffness about it when the animal is trying to use everything it's got to stay upright, to take steps, whatever it is. And, you know, using the physio roll or the peanut, you know, you give them permission to just relax and release and just be and to be static. You know, and to really be able to access the nervous system again in a different way. So yeah, there's a method to our madness. It's really, amazing what we're able to accomplish. Obviously having that reasoning and having that function as the end result, that end goal, you know, it's obviously very important, that we have that understanding and we're able to tell ourselves and remind ourselves as to why, you know, why this is working. And I think that's what's so rewarding about reading about neuroplasticity and learning about it is just, it's answering a lot of those why questions. You know, why does this work? Why does the animal respond the way that they do after surgery or after injury?
Amy, we thought as we wrap up our conversation today, which has been so awesome, that we talk about a couple of cases, that Kathy and I have had, and, you know, maybe you can give some input, but I had a little Maltese that in 2014, when she was let out first thing in the morning, right at dawn with her older sister, unbeknownst to the owners, there was a coyote in the backyard. And before this owner could react, the coyote had grabbed ZD by the neck and, you know, started, you know, shaking and what have you. The owner went in to, you know, get a tool like a shovel or something from the garage. And when he came back out, ZD was lying there. The coyote had jumped the fence, but she was badly injured. And so there was some direct trauma to the spinal cord in the area of the neck. And she, of course, was taken to emergency and then eventually seen by a neurologist. And the prognosis was pretty pessimistic. But the neurologist had said, you know, let's give it, you know, about 3 months. I think that that's probably going to be, you know, where ZD recovers. You know, that we're not going to get much more after that time. And even during that time at various rechecks and so forth was continuing to talk to the pet parent about euthanasia as maybe the most humane option. But for this owner, that wasn't an option. And ZD started therapy pretty early on after the trauma. I don't think the neurologist referred ZD to me. I think the pet parent found me. And we just started doing all the things that we've talked about in this conversation. And I remember going to that recheck with the neurologist at about that 3 month mark with the dog and the owner, because I said, I want to be there. I want to know what they say and explain what I call the shades of gray. So, you know, sometimes the veterinarians will see things in very black and white terms and talking about that regeneration, you know, maybe this neurologist felt like the nerve is only going to have the capacity to regenerate for, you know, 12 weeks. And after that, we're really not going to get much more. But we have not only substitution, but all of this neuroplasticity to work with, and recovery can be extended for months and months and months and months, you know, even, you know, years. I always tell people, you know, let's give it at least a year if they're willing. And these people certainly were. And she was easy to manage because she was so tiny. And I just texted in preparation for this conversation today, her owner. ZD is now 13 years old. She is full of vim and vigor. She doesn't walk perfectly. She still has one front limb that's a little bit wacky, but boy, she can keep up. The owner's daughter got a new puppy, and she plays and wrestles and does all this stuff with the puppy at age 13. And Mary Ellen, her owner, said, you know, Zeta was instrumental in my survival and coping during this pandemic time and so forth. And she has absolutely no regrets.
That is amazing. And, you know, you think about too, some of the words that jumped out at me, it's support and, you know, and encouragement and, you know, knowing when to push and when to progress and, you know, how much to give and take and all that. And then just keeping an open mind about everything, right? And, mm-hmm. and the opportunities that you had in rehabilitation and that she had to lead, you know, a fairly normal life. I mean, mm-hmm. it's an amazing story, but it really does show the resilience of the nervous system and the body and the benefits in this whole process and in healing.
So yeah. I am going to get some pictures and such, and we'll post those of ZD on Instagram in relationship to this podcast.
Perfect. Thanks, Chris.
And it's, you know, it's those cases that inspire you for the next, you know, and they give so much to us, and then they allow us to give so much to others, right? And we learn from them mm-hmm. and our experiences and how to keep going.
I'm wondering, as we're wrapping up, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to share with the audience? Any pearls of information?
No, you know what? I think a lot of it's stepping back. It's putting yourself in your pet's position and trying to experience the world from their body, from their perception, and then just not being afraid or intimidated by their injury. You know, there's a whole team surrounding you that's there to help. But, you know, just putting your hands on and making that connection, that physical and emotional connection with your pet, I think it will pay forward so much and really make a huge difference in their lives and yours too.
It really will. And Amy, can you also tell our audience, where can they find you?
Good
where
question.
Can they find you, Amy?
Where in the world?
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, we're all so connected, fortunately, online. You know, as I mentioned, or as Chris mentioned, I was in the Boston area. I'm now in the Netherlands, but for only maybe 8 more months or so. I am accessible online. I do coaching and mentoring of both rehab professionals and pet parents, and especially in neurologic rehabilitation. My website is www.empowerphysio.com, empowerphysiopt.com. And I can also be found on Teachable. It's empowerphysio.teachable.com.
Wonderful. Thank you, Amy. We learned so much today. We'll put all that in the show notes. Wonderful. All right. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
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 Thank you for joining us. We hope you enjoyed our show. Follow us on Facebook or on Instagram at Petability Podcast.
For more information about Kathy's books and living with blind dogs, please go to enableyourpet.com. Thank you, and please tune in next time.